So I wanted to go back a little bit to something that you mentioned earlier, and that was you mentioned that your mother was a computer engineer and that you had maybe an aunt who had been the mayor of her...
My grandmother.
Okay. Right. And I wanted to ask maybe if you could talk a bit more about how you've seen... Because one of the rhetorical... attributes of the socialist regime was that women had more, women were more equal.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've seen in the experience of your own family and in your knowledge and the work that you've done on the communist period in mm-hmm. Bulgaria, how have women fared just from your observations under socialism versus post-socialism?
Yeah, that's actually an extremely interesting question. The whole project of the communist regime was to make genders equal, right, in a sense. But I think that was more rhetoric than actual fact. Of course, a lot of women started working in factories, working in like agriculture, sort of, you know. So you didn't have that kind of gender division of labor. And yet Bulgaria as a sort of agrarian society, which used to be in before 44 in a very patriarchal kind of structure, the Soviet Union for that matter, continued those kind of patriarchal structures. Basically, women, yes, they could get jobs, they could work in factories, they became in a sense equal to men. At the same time, they continued to do all the housework at home. It was not accepted for men to help, really. And very few, I mean, there are, of course, exceptions, but very few men actually helped at home, helped with raising the kids. So in a sense, the woman, like, she got a job and at the same time continued raising, you know, the kids and doing all the house chores, of course. And so basically it's like she got double the work that she was doing before. And of course, there was like the 8th of March, you know, International Women's Day, when everybody would go and take a flower to their like female colleague or like, you know, their mother or anything like this. But this was sort of symbolic. It was a sort of a symbolic rite. It didn't really mean that women were respected or were equal to men. And if you think of also of all the managing positions in factories, in the Politburo in Bulgaria, they were all like mostly 90% men. Mm. So I think and I think in that way it reflected also the gender inequalities in the West as well. Mm. So I think that those two worlds were not separate. So in a sense, and talking about sex, let's say, I mean, I would say that it was something that. It was probably the only kind of freedom that people had at the time. But also, it was not talked about, right? It was like completely like hidden under this moralistic language. And if you read some of the communist handbooks on like how to raise your kids, you know, the communist ones, and it would be like, you know, if your kid is masturbating, you have to like, you know, to like put on like light underwear and to have him keep his hands over the blanket and all of these things. So it's almost like as the language about sex is almost as dogmatic as sort of Christian, like evangelical language. And that kind of a moralistic attitude, I think spilled over. And it was, you know, you'd think that communism, well, communes, you know, people, you know, having, you know, the families, we should destroy the family structure because it's bourgeois, right, and all this. But in fact, it preserved all these patriarchal structures to preserve. Now, after 89, basically, you know, we had all this Western consumer culture come in. And of course, you know, the hypersexualization of female bodies and of objectification and all this. I mean, everything that was in the West came... Bulgaria, except that it was like really, you know, sort of copied in excess. Let's put it this way. Mm. So it was not like, to a certain extent, I think the West has managed to, I mean, because of all the feminist discourse from the 60s and 70s and sort of like people have managed to at least, yes, the female body is highly sexualized in the West, but at the same time there is a counter discourse that is running and is trying to bring, you know, more equality and more understanding of gender issues. Well, in Bulgaria, we didn't have that discourse, the feminist discourse. So basically, we just had this hyper-sexualized culture without the counterweight, without sort of critical attitude towards what was going on. And it's still, you know, if you look at the advertising, the you know, the huge billboards, the advertising, the you know, the way, you know, women, you know, advertise alcohol with their, like, bodies. And it's, like, highly sexualized. In the States, like, I don't think you'd ever see, or in Western Europe, that kind of... It's almost pornographic. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that, yeah, and at the same time, that kind of I mean, it's still a very patriarchal society. And I would say former Soviet Union as well. Although people say, oh, but Ukrainian girls dress, like, you know, in these short skirts and all that. But in fact, if you look at how you know, like, if you look at the what most families are like, it's girls get married at 22 or 23, you know, to their high school love. And then they get pregnant and most of them push strollers by the age of 24. And then their, you know, husbands are drunkards and they get divorced and all these women are raising their kids alone. So in fact, that pattern continues even to this day. But yeah, it's just more, you know, I think the position of women in Bulgaria is, I don't know, I wouldn't say they're unequal to men, but definitely you have these remnants of patriarchy. That are there, and I think that definitely the feminist discourse is highly, I mean, it's not as developed as in the West. There's some, you know, here and there, but it's extremely isolated. It's not part of the mainstream culture at all. Mm-hmm.
So was your mother a computer engineer before the collapse of socialism? Did she start doing that?
Yeah, she did. She did cybernetics, actually.
Yeah, because Bulgaria was an innovator in that regard. Because
I would not call it an innovator exactly. I would call it you know after sort of the you know, all the countries in the Soviet bloc distributed sort of the economic zones, right? The CIF, mm-hmm. it was called. Mm-hmm. So Bulgaria got the high tech sector, but in fact, what they were doing was they were stealing technology from IBM, reverse engineering IBM computers, and producing them as Bulgarian computers.
But that's hard.
That's hard. That's hard, but they were doing it. Yeah, I had a Bulgarian computer back in 1987.
Yeah, I mean, Bulgarian computers were computers in the socialist bloc, right?
Yeah,
that
yeah.
So how did your mother, or your family in particular, experience... I mean, how did she come to be interested in it, first of all, and what was her kind of career trajectory like in light of this whole Bulgaria being...
She was on the national team, Bulgarian national mathematics team. Mm-hmm. So basically, after high school, she went to a sort of a specialized mathematics school, as there are, you know, many of those around the Soviet bloc. Mm-hmm. And so after that, she didn't have an idea what she was doing. And she saw this new cybernetics specialty and she applied. She was the only woman in the class. And so she continued with that. And then she was working for the Ministry of Internal Affairs after she graduated, creating software for tracking down stolen cars.
So this is like
in the
late
70s, 80s, 80s, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that's what she was doing. And then my grandmother, she was a librarian actually, mm-hmm. but she applied. She, you know, ran as a mayor and she won. And she, I think, she was extremely good. And she managed to get reelected. And then after the end of communism, you know, there was this purge of all former communist officials. So she resigned. But then you know, in 94, she ran again, and she was re-elected as, you know, free, sort of free elections. So she was, after the end of communism, she was again, for one term, a mayor of the village. Wow. Yeah. So I come from a family of very strong women, but I think that, you know, even though they've managed, they've been successful and all that, I can see that they've done this, you know, at a high price and something that, you know, is more of an exception than the rule for women to manage to rise up in spite of all the obstacles that they face. So
so when you say high price, you mean censure from other people or
No, I would say just you know, the effort that it takes to do this and to raise a family and to, you know, when your husbands are not helping at all. And my father, you know, he was writing a dissertation at the time and you know, he was not that involved with my, you know, upbringing. so my mom did all of that by herself. My grandmother raised two kids by herself and my grandfather didn't help her at all. He was very, like, hands-off. So, and they still managed to, you know, be more successful than their husbands in their respective careers. So, so I think that's something to be proud of.
Indeed. So, you have, just to switch gears here, so you've not shied away from controversy or danger in your reporting. So, most recently in Ukraine, in Crimea, and I think in it was in Ukraine where you were attacked, right?
In Crimea.
In Crimea, okay. And you wrote a piece on a Bulgarian mafia figure turned author, Georgi Stoyev, and, you know, you get close to circles that, you know, for whom life is not as expansive as for some others. And you've also done the coverage on the former Yugoslavia. Can you talk about some particularly harrowing experiences that you've had and how you relate to danger as a journalist or as a writer?
Yeah. I'm not one of those thrill seekers, I have to say, you know, because there's... I have a lot of, you know, journalist friends who are conflict reporters and they are hooked. It's the adrenaline, it's the adventure, and so... That's what they're looking for. They're looking to go to the front lines. I'm not that kind of person, and I shy away from this kind of thing, because I feel it can warp your understanding of an issue when you're constantly in danger and looking for that, just as much as when you're not in danger at all. and so, like one experience. So the Crimea experience was that basically we were attacked. My photographer and I were attacked by paramilitaries. Because we were, we witnessed a raid on a TV studio at the time of before the referendum in Crimea. Basically, the media was like the main target, and so there was an AP studio in central Simferopol, and it was raided by paramilitaries. And we witnessed that, and we started photographing, of course, from across the street. But then they saw us, and rushed towards us, you know, put me on the ground, like with a gun to my head, took away my phone. My friend lost her camera, you know, professional camera. So that was sort of a harrowing experience. But of course, you know, I mean, a lot of journalists, I think, face much, much harsher treatment, especially now in Eastern Ukraine. But I don't, yeah, it's, I think it's just, you accept certain risks and that's it. And afterwards, if, you know, you hope for the best. I'm not sure if you know, my mom thinks that I'm looking for this kind of place, but I'm not. And I was in Iraq, actually, in 2010, as embedded in the U.S. Army, so going on these, like, missions and where you never know where you're going to run into an IED, like, with every mission. And so it was a little bit scary, and it gives you a different perspective because, you know, hey, this could be the last day of my life. And so it just, you're thinking about these things, but generally I wouldn't call myself like a conflict, you know, reporter or like a person who's looking for danger necessarily. Mm-hmm. As much as like, oh, I'm interested in the story, and if the story involves a dangerous element, then so be it.
Mm-hmm. What is in your mind, the story that you've written that you've been the most satisfied with? In terms of, and maybe you could talk about how it came into being.
I have a favorite story actually, and it's in Belarus. From it's about tractors.
I haven't read that one.
I'll send you the story. But I'm sorry. Just turn on the phone. So what happened was that the magazine, I'm a contributing editor for the Virginia Quarterly Review. Mm-hmm. So back in 2011, we were doing an issue on the 20th anniversary of the end of the Soviet Union. So we were doing a Soviet issue. And the idea was for each and every reporter to go to a different former Soviet republic and to see how, except for Russia, you know, and to see how all these republics have taken different routes.
Oh.
And, you know, so it's interesting. They came out as a single country, and suddenly 20 years later, you have the Baltics, you have Ukraine and Belarus,
yeah.
You have, like, Central Asian dictatorships. So it was just very interesting to track that.
Yeah.
And so I ended up going to Belarus, and my editor at the time, Ted Genovese, he was like, so, you know, he was asking me what I could do in Belarus, and first we were thinking of doing this story about, like, the Belarus supposedly had the highest rate of suicides in the world, even more than Japan and
Hungary.
And Hungary, yeah. So we were looking at that, but then, you know, what that was one story we could do. And then he's like, but okay, like, tell me what's the first thing that comes to your mind when you think of Belarus? And I said, immediately, tractors.
Makes sense.
Because, you know, in my village, when my grandmother was a mayor, you know, she would, like, take me to the collective farm, and we would, like, there were all these Belarus tractors there. And so they were called Belarus, and I remember, like, taking rides on the Belarus tractors. And that, you know, in my childhood memory, that's the thing that's been imprinted. It's like Belarus, all tractors. And then I, you know, did a little bit of research, and it came about that actually Belarus had preserved its tractor industry. It's still one of the biggest tractor producers mm-hmm. in the world. And, you know, it's mostly for Russia, you know, for, like, you know, Eastern Europe. You know, I don't think they... And I think Venezuela, they were, like, exporting tractors to Venezuela and Syria. So friendly regimes, so to speak. But then my editor is like, oh, great, you're doing a story about tractors. And so the idea was actually to go into Belarus and to do a story about Belarus through this, like, industry, like, that they've been famous for, and to go to factories and to talk to workers and to do a political, maybe, portrait of Belarus, but through sort of this industrial, this industrial angle. And I called the factory, and, you know, they talked to the director, and he's like, yeah, you can come over, we'll show you around. But because Belarus does not give journalist visas, so I applied for a tourist visa. So in front of the Belarusian authorities, I was a tourist, but for the factory director, of course, I told him who I'm working for, so on and so forth. But, you know, that was stupid of me, of course, because, even when I was getting my Belarus visa, they already, they called me sort of to a side room and said, we know you're a journalist and, you know, we're giving you a tourist visa, but you really should be a tourist there. And, you know, I had booked this fake Minsk tour, you know, all of this to be able to go around unmolested. But so I met there. I met there with a great friend, Jason Motla, who used to be a Time reporter from Afghanistan, and he was doing a story on the 25th anniversary of Chernobyl from the Belarusian side, where most of the fallout was actually not on the Ukrainian side. So I was doing my story, he was doing his story, and we just decided to team up. I would be his translator, and he would do the photographs from my story. Mm. So, and just to be safe.
Mm.
So, anyhow, after, you know, we went there, nobody, like, the factory, they decided they don't want me, and they would not let me, you know, go in or talk to any of the people. Suddenly their opinion changed. I had to talk to these, like, security people. I think it's just the KGBs there, still there. They knew, you know, what I was up to. So they just, like, denied me access to everything. So we decided to go through the back door and go through. There was another factory in a small town, Mozyr,
mm-hmm.
Sort of down south from Minsk. And so we decided to go there. And after a series of adventure where, like, my passport disappeared, and I could have lost it, maybe, but I'm so careful with my passport, I don't know. So immediately after my passport disappeared, we were apprehended by the KGB. And so it was sort of a grueling interrogation. I ended up being in jail for about a week.
Holy cow.
Yeah, so Jason was immediately extradited from the country. But yeah, so I was kept in jail in sort of this solitary confinement, and I had no idea, you know, when they're going to let me out, because they, at first it was going to be 24 hours, then 48 hours, and then it was indefinite detention.
Oh, my God.
So, and because we were doing this factory stuff, it's hard to convince the KGB that you're, like, not doing industrial espionage or something like this, that you're doing a story about tractors.
Yeah.
And it seems like I always get into these kind of stories where, like, oh, it's a perfect cover. He's an agent. Right? Like, it's impossible that he's writing,
could actually,
like, be interested in tractors. But in fact, you know, I did all this research into tractors and like watched all these movies and like this like pop culture around
all
tractors during Stalinism,
yeah.
and the musicals, and I loved this, and I wanted to like sort of I brought in all of this in my article afterwards, but half of the article was about, of course, you know, the adventures, like
with,
so the story is like how my love of tractors got me arrested by the KGB.
That's so good.
So in any case, they at the end, you know, Bulgarian authorities were so slow, but in the end they took me to the Minsk airport on this like unmarked van. They put me on a plane. They banned me from going back for 3 years, and they brought on this document that I'm a threat to public order. And I'm like, how am I a threat to public order? Anyway, so that was my experience in Belarus. And I think the article, actually, it's one of my favorites, as it turned out.
It's definitely a hard one.
Yeah.
And you never even got inside the factory.
Though. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but I, you know, we were passing through these, like, you know, farms, and we saw this guy who had his own, like, Belarus tractor. Like, oh, can we get a ride? And so we were, like, going through Belarus on this tractor. And it was, like, an adventure, but at the same time, it was a serious article about Belarusian culture and the tractors and, like, what they meant and, like, the machine in Soviet culture and all of this, like, I don't know. I liked it. I liked it. And it was, yeah. Yeah, so that was my favorite one.
I'll have to read that one. That sounds great. So you've also lived here in Turkey, and you've traveled and written about the Danube, the Black Sea, as we were talking about Ukraine, Crimea, the former Yugoslavia. And, you know, those of us who have made Eastern Europe, say, an object of our academic study, or perpetually returning to the question of whether or not Eastern Europe even exists.
Mm. Right.
And I would love to get your perspective on that question. I mean, is there really such a thing as Eastern Europe in your mind? Or is it really just a Cold War construct? Is there something that, I mean, and how would, if you think there is one, how would you define what it is?
I don't think that Eastern Europe really existed before the Soviet occupation of Eastern Europe. I mean, in a sense, what existed was sort of the post-Ottoman world in the Balkans. I think that world shared a culture. Serbia, Bulgaria, parts of Romania, Greece, I think. And because of this Ottoman experience of, you know, 5 centuries being part of the Ottoman Empire. Mm-hmm. And I'll, you know, call it more of a kind of a post-colonial experience even. And there was this shared thing, but then Bulgaria had nothing to do with the Czechoslovakia or Poland. I think they've had such different histories, or Russia for that matter. But then, you know, after 1944, I think we shared the other sort of post-colonial or sort of we had another empire, you know, on our territory, and we had to share, you know, that imperial culture was imposed and, so to speak. And so what we share today with, you know, the Czechs or the Poles, we share that sort of Soviet, mm-hmm. you know, mentality, let's put it this way, or post-Soviet mentality, which is more prevalent in some countries than others. But I think that's what unites. I can understand very well people from Poland these days, not because we share, you know, like so many, you know, like historical things, it's like just culturally, the Soviet world, they were part of the Soviet world.
Do you think it's that, you know, the experience of communism, or for something like your generation, the experience of transition, or whatever we call it? That, I mean, that was your kind of coming of age and theirs, I suppose. How much of it is actual socialism versus the transition, or I think that's a loaded term.
Yeah, you're right. But I think the transition was very different in different. Like, I think Bulgaria's transition was similar to like Ukraine's or Russia's transition in its really traumatic kind of dimension. You know, the Yugoslav transition was connected to the war, so right. Different. I don't think Bulgarians can relate very well to former Yugoslavia in that way because they have not experienced this kind of conflict. You know, the Czech Republic and Slovakia had their own, like, pretty mild transition, I would say, and successful. It's like Poland as well. Poland has been a model country in that way. Although they had some harsh, you know, times in the 90s, I think that, you know, looking at it now, it's perhaps the only stable country outside of Germany in the European Union. It's So I'm not sure if we share so much of the, you know, I think, like, when I speak to Russians and Ukrainians, I can, like, relate, oh, how the mafia sort of, the mafia networks and how they took over the state and how the state became the mafia and so on. But I think that's very particular to countries like Bulgaria, to a certain extent, Romania, Ukraine, Russia. But it's not particular, I think, so much to the Baltics or to Poland or to Hungary and Czech Republic. I think they had a more sort of successful kind of transition in their own way. And they had their mafia, of course, and they had their own, like, old communist state security structures involved in privatization and so on and so forth. But it was not to this enormous extent that it happened in Bulgaria or Russia. Mm-hmm. So I can tell you that when I speak to people who grew up in the 60s, I grew up in the 80s, we share a lot more than people who grew up 5 years after me. Seriously, like, just things about childhood and things we watched, and it seemed like, because time was moving, history was moving at a very slow rate still in the 60s, 70s, 80s. Mm-hmm. And once, you know, sort of the gates were open and suddenly there was all this consumer culture coming in, all this, like, and the internet, of course, afterwards and all this. So I can speak, I have more, I relate better to people who, like, 30 years older than I, or 20, than people who are 5 years younger.
Interesting.
It's so it is a sort of a strange thing.
It's interesting you should cast it as, you know, like the post-communist period as an acceleration of time somehow. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you talked about Poland, right, and how it had some rough points in the 90s, but that now that it seems to be, you know, doing pretty well. Yeah. I mean, if you looked at Hungary 5 years ago,
yeah,
the picture again would be quite different. Or Slovakia 7 years
right.
ago or 10. I mean, the fascinating thing is how it really depends when you ask.
It's true.
You know, wait 5 minutes, something could be completely different. I mean, look at Romania now, for example, as compared to the way it was just a few years
yeah.
ago.
Yeah.
It's it seems to be a very different trajectory. And to what extent, I mean, when you talk about acceleration, what are the elements of, I mean, what are the symptoms of accelerated time, would you say?
Well, if you think even like in academia, mm-hmm. We miss the entire sort of structuralism, post-structuralism, you know, 60s, 70s, and you look at Bulgaria academia from the 1990s, mm-hmm. it's like, okay, we're going to have a little period, like 2 years of structuralism, then we're going to have like 2 years of post-structuralism, and now like a little bit of new historicism. And so it was, you know, people were catching up. They wanted to catch up because they had missed all of this history. I mean, it was like after the end of the Ottoman Empire. Mm-hmm. So we missed the Renaissance, we missed the Enlightenment, you know, all of this. And people, you could see these little periods of like, okay, now it's like late 19th century, a little bit of like Enlightenment sort of, you know, politics, but then like really quickly Romanticism. And then it changed, and until we catch up in the 1920s and 30s with like the modernist movements, and finally, you know, we're part of sort of the greater, you know, stream of European culture, so to speak. But before that, you'd see it's like, oh, we don't have this period. We are missing this period. We need to like have this kind of culture. And I'm exaggerating, of course, but it seemed like that kind of catching up was happening, you know, after Bulgaria's liberation, and then after 89, mm-hmm. when people felt they felt inadequate somehow, that, you know, of course, people in certain circles, they knew about these movements and all that, they had read, you know, Derrida or Foucault or whatever. But at the same time, it was not like they were not allowed to really talk about this in their official papers. Or so in academia, you could see that, and just generally, you know, people just, you know, looked at, you know, in movies and everything. They just want to catch up, and to, and you could see that that sort of acceleration that suddenly, you know, all of these things that we missed for 45 years, you know, they were like free for consumption. Mm-hmm. And so people, like, I mean, there was no order, no structure in how these things were consumed. They just like flooded Bulgaria. And so I felt in that way that time somehow had accelerated. Mm-hmm. But I think that's the just general trend. And after, especially with the internet, like who, like, yeah, now history is like this, you know, just like every year it's like faster than the previous one, and mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or so, yeah, so it seems. Well, you know, there are a couple of things on this point. One is that, you know, that Eastern Europe kind of struggles internally and externally with, you know, kind of being cast as, or casting itself as, a place that is lacking somehow,
right.
Like as an absence,
right,
of something rather than a presence of something. And a lot of the compensation for that is kind of nationalism, nativism,
mm-hmm.
or some, you know, like, we don't need that, we go our own,
yeah,
way. Kind of thing. Is there, a couple of things. One is, how do you think Eastern Europeans can address this, the narrative of lack,
right,
or absence? And the other is, when Bulgarians and others were kind of tearing through, you know, kind of decades of ideas,
mm-hmm.
are there some, because, you know, those ideas arose in a certain context.
Of course,
and
yeah,
were resonated for particular reasons in the context in which they arose, and then the ones in which they traveled, so France, and then later,
yeah,
the United States, and then, you know, all kinds of places. But is there something that in that, you know, in kind of going through all of those those ideas, something that resonated particularly with what was happening to people at the time, that kind of has more staying power, let's say, ideationally than
mm-hmm.
others?
It's a hard question. You know, there is this this Bulgarian philosopher, critic, Alexander Kiosev, who teaches at Sofia University, and so he introduced this term of like self-colonization,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, because of this lack that, or supposed lack that we feel, that we actually try to colonize ourselves, like, you know, we try to bring in this new culture, this new kind of you know, literature and everything, and nobody's imposing this on us, really. It is an act of self-colonization that you go and you seek for that culture yourself. And so I think that's something that's still true to a certain extent. And as you say, you know, there are all these nativist movements. Let's go back to, you know, our own history, but. You know, the general trend has been, yes, to it, that, you know, a lot of people feel, oh, our culture is inadequate, we should take this and that. Of course, that's also a sort of a wrong way to approach. I mean, it's a very uncritical way to approach, oftentimes, you know, the legacy of another country. And it's a very, you know, and as you said, this legacy was very specific in terms of, like, the context, historical context, what happened. How does it apply to Bulgaria? So oftentimes there are these transplants that don't mean anything to Bulgaria, but they're just there because we need to be part of Europe. Unfortunately, we have not reclaimed sort of the Ottoman, you know, legacy as much. But I feel Bulgaria is like very, I feel culturally it's closer to Turkey than it's closer to, you know, Europe.
Mm-hmm.
I do. It's... And, you know, people would probably kill me for saying that, but you know, it's so I'm not sure if, you know, maybe there, I'm not sure if there have been ideas with this kind of staying power even like democracy, you know, is like maybe some kind of, but like the, I don't know. I think that the problem is that because we sort of always look west or look maybe sometimes to Russia, but like this Ottoman element is missing oftentimes. And I think that's what, you know, I would like to see more. Not sure if I'm answering your question well.
No, this is good, because one thing we haven't talked about is Turkey, which is where we are, right?
Right.
So, you know, when Bulgarians look to Turkey, even if they were to look with some kind of sympathy or admiration, yeah, which a lot of Bulgarians don't, but maybe, you know, like you,
right,
you do, what they would be seeing is not necessarily the Ottoman legacy, but the Kemalist legacy, in part, at least. And which is a secularizing,
yeah,
you know, the same
right
kind of thing that we just talked about. Yeah. So, what, when you talk about how Bulgarians and Turks or Bulgarian Turkey have more in common, like, or what is the, is it historical experience? Is it a kind of culture? Where does that resonate the most? Or is it, you know, the necessity of kind of returning to, or recognizing that there's something indigenous and interesting
yeah
about the Ottoman period that I think is happening in Turkey right now,
right,
with various political, you know, valences.
Yeah. Well, the interesting part is that Bulgarians don't think of Turkey as the Kemalist Turkey. They do think of Turkey as still the Ottoman Turkey, because that's what all the textbooks are about. Mm. They're about the yoke.
Right.
And so it's actually it's an extremely wrong-headed historiography that was, you know, that had a history, of course, back after liberation and sort of the anti-Turkish, anti-Ottoman sentiments, but also the communists developed that further by creating this kind of nationalism, where the Turks, you know, the whole period was this black hole, you know, from 1396. I'd say to 1878, it was just like, you know, nothing happened in that period, which is not true. It's an extremely interesting period, and of course, Bulgarians, like as all Christians, and I wouldn't even speak of Bulgarians, I'll speak of Christians, because people at the time would firstly identify according to their religion rather than, you know, so the sort of the nationalist identity came more in the 19th century. But so Christians, of course, they were second-rate citizens. Second-class citizens, they couldn't, you know, they didn't have, they were paying more taxes, but that's why their identity was preserved in a way, because the Ottoman Empire liked to have a lot of Christian subjects who paid a lot of taxes. And so people don't think about it. They think, oh, we were so strong as Bulgarians that we preserved our identity for 500 years. And I'm like, no, it was a multicultural empire, and they could have Islamized the whole place very quickly, in fact, if they had wanted to by force. But in fact, as we know, you know, Turkey, I would say the Ottoman Empire, was a much more tolerant empire than, let's say, you know, the British Empire or the Spanish in South America, where, you know, we know that a lot of the Sephardic Jews from Spain came to the Ottoman Empire, where they could actually practice their religion. Again, they were, you know, as Christians, they were people of the book. For the Muslims, and they were not full citizens, but at the, you know, not full, not, you know, full rights as citizens, but at the same time, they were not persecuted the way they were in Spain, or the way, you know, these kind of pogroms were happening in Russia or so on. So I think that Bulgarians have this cute idea of the Ottoman period. And they think of this slavery as the yoke, as we were, you know, that we were paying defshirme, which
right
was the, you know,
blood tax.
and yes, of course, these things were happening at one point or another in the history of the Ottoman Empire, but they were not, I mean, they were not the only things that were happening. It was not like just blood and destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, in the late 19th century, the Ottoman Empire was falling apart. There were a lot of massacres of Christians, but they were also massacring Alevis, and you know, so Bulgarians don't have a very complex understanding of the Ottoman period, and it's a cartoonish kind of thing, where it's like, I think the Serbs are the same in certain ways, So we don't want to reclaim that legacy. But I think that, like, culturally, in terms of like family structures, it's very similar, sort of this more oriental kind of mentality. You know, music, oftentimes it's like, it's not Russian influence, it's Ottoman influence, that's Turkish influence. Very few people have been to Turkey, in fact. I've spoken to a lot of friends who are like, oh, why are you going to Turkey? Why are you going to Istanbul? And they still think of this as the Ottoman Empire, and that wants to take us over. And now there is this discourse that Erdogan is like moving into the Balkans, mm-hmm. and he's like creating this new Ottoman Empire, and we have to resist it. But you could see it as also a more benevolent kind of structure where it's an economic partner. It's a huge economic power, and why not, you know, sort of use our... We have 10% Turkish minority in Bulgaria. Why not use our cultural ties to Turkey to sort of be a bridge between Turkey and Europe, in a sense? Yeah. And not so much between Russia and Europe. I'm a little bit like, you know, anti-Russian here, but it's true. I feel that Turks are closer to our understanding. And these things are general, and sometimes, you know, you could fall into stereotypes and all this. But I feel that, you know, Turkish culture is just more relaxed in that way. It's not... Human life is more valued in Turkish culture than it is in, I would say, that it is in Russian culture. and there is, you know, I mean, looking at my father's family is Gagauz. So his father, my grandfather is Gagauz. They came from actually what was what's now Alexandroupoli in Greece. It was the Deach, it was called at the time, and they moved in the early 20th century as refugees. But yeah, they were Christian Turks. Yeah. And the reason that my grandfather did not learn Turkish in the 30s when his parents were speaking Turkish is that, you know, in the 30s there was a big campaign, mm-hmm. to like nationalist campaign, change all the toponyms. Mm-hmm. Change all, like, you know, like anything that was a legacy of the Ottoman Empire. Which had stayed in Bulgaria until the 1930s, had to be removed. So languages are also not like looked, you know, if somebody's speaking Turkish, not looked upon very, very fondly. So I started discovering these things when I was going back to my family history. Like, my parents were not interested at all in this, and they were children of communism in a sense. You know, they were not thinking, and they were taught to think of themselves as Bulgarians in these like nationalist terms. But in fact, when you go back, like, my grandfather is Gagauz. The other part of my father's family comes from Edirne.
Oh.
So my grandmother is actually, I don't know if I should call her Romanian, but she's bilingual. She lives on the Romanian-Bulgarian border, and her parents spoke Romanian.
Wow.
So she never taught me Romanian because my mother... said that they were thinking of this as a village language, as a language that, you know, you have to stay away from this. They weren't thinking of it as like wealth, as something that was like additional language, as, you know, more complex identity. They were thinking of it, oh, you don't want to study, you know, it's almost like a gypsy language, you know. Mm-hmm. But my grandmother, now I brought a Romanian friend, and she was just so... And she spoke Romanian. My friend said she speaks perfect Romanian. You know, and so you see these things, you know, when you go back just three or four generations, not more than that, in the Balkans, and you see this mixture of cultures and of religions and of languages, and you see how impoverished our Balkan culture has become from this like communist legacy, which tried to impose a single nationalist identity on people. And especially, you can still see that, you know, the more diverse culture in the border areas. In Romania, certainly, Romania is a much more diverse country than ethnically than Bulgaria. But Bulgaria used to be like that. And now, you know, these kind of legacies, old legacies, the Ottoman legacy or Greek legacy or Romanian, you know, they're not looked upon. They're not even, like, I would say, considered. I don't think a lot of Bulgarians like think of these common legacies. So it's sort of sad, and I wish that, you know, that we had more of this Balkan kind of. I think the Balkans share a certain culture that is the Ottoman culture, and that we still, you know, it's not a negative thing, in my opinion.
So, did the recent events in Ukraine surprise you?
Yeah, I think everybody was surprised by what happened, and I think what people were thinking is that, oh, Russia's now part of the global economy, and therefore it would have, because it's so well integrated, it would have a conservative foreign policy, mm-hmm. and it would not do anything that would endanger its place in the global economy. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where people are wrong, because they didn't understand that Russians, maybe they're interested in money, but not only money, and that sort of nationalist discourse is so strong mm-hmm. that people sometimes are willing to forego certain financial benefits in order to. I mean, I think at a certain point, like, Russians just felt that, you know, I don't think that's true, but they felt, oh, that they were, you know, that the West was imposing this, you know, identity on them, and they were losing their identity. But it was mostly created, I think, a nationalist discourse created by Putin, or using older nationalist discourse, you know, from older times. And And in a sense, that was not surprising, but also it was surprising that things happened so fast and changed so quickly. I don't know. It's mm-hmm. it's hard to say. And what I was saying is that, you know, the other night when we were talking, is that it's so much hard. I think Putin, what he succeeded in doing with this war, is actually to get the sort of the opposition, the liberal opposition, so to speak, on his side, and who were really the biggest danger to him. They were not like the people out in Siberia as much as those people in Moscow and St. Petersburg. And suddenly, like, there is no real dissidence in Russia, because in the Soviet Union, dissidence was also oftentimes closely related to nationalism. Mm-hmm. So if you're a Soviet dissident from Russia, you're oftentimes a Russian nationalist. Mm-hmm. And that's why these people were looked, you know, positively. They had this positive image that they were bringing back Russia, that they were, you know, so a lot of the people, they had a lot of support. And now, to be a dissident in Russia means also to be an anti-nationalist, mm-hmm. and oftentimes anti-Russian in certain ways.
Right, by their definition, yeah.
Right, so yeah, I mean, it's a very complex situation. I'm not sure if I understand it very well.
Well, who does? You came to the academic study of the field right through literature, mm-hmm. and through Russian literature in particular, is that right?
Yeah, Russian literature, I mean, that was like what I did my BA on. I did it on Joseph Brodsky and W.H. Auden.
Oh, yes.
So it was a comparative study of Joseph Brodsky and Auden. Yeah.
That's fantastic. I took a class with him at Mount Holyoke.
You did?
Yeah. Oh, my God. I audited it.
Yeah. I'm not sure he was a very pleasant person from what I've heard.
So he was extremely interesting. And yeah. I mean, well, that's a different story, but I have only ever regretted that I only audited it rather than taking it properly.
Did he recite poetry in the class?
Not exactly. What the requirement was that we had to memorize a poem for every class.
Right, right.
And you could only make 3 mistakes, and that could be punctuation, line break. I mean, and if you didn't, if you made more than 3, you just sort of got a 0 for the day.
Yeah.
And then we would discuss the poem, and he would read parts of it with his very Russian accent.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he would ask us for interpretations, but ours were so lame. That one of the ones I remember was September 1st, 1939, and when he was talking about skyscrapers use their full height to proclaim, blind skyscrapers use their full height to proclaim the strength of collective man.
Right, right.
And he asked us our opinion on that matter, and somebody said something about what blind skyscrapers would be. He just Then he proceeded to give this gorgeous explanation of the blind skyscrapers. And he went through the exercise of, you know, of asking our views, but I don't think that there was much, that the Enlightenment was going one way, not two. but it was a fascinating experience, and to this day I only hear Auden with a Russian accent, you know, like the way that he would, because he pronounced each language pours its vain competitive excuse, and he pronounces excuse and excuse in the same way, and you know that I can't not hear that line as excuse.
Interesting. The Russian Auden.
Right. Yeah. It's the only Auden there is, as far as I'm concerned. Good. So I wanted to talk about literature because you write poetry. You've translated Elizabeth Bishop into Bulgarian, right? So literature, right? How did you come to it, and what is it? What has it meant to you in your other writing?
Well, I don't know. I think I came to literature. I disliked my literature class in high school, and the only reason I started studying literature was because of my American literature teacher. And she suddenly, you know, because in Bulgaria, what you do is like you write this "odgovor na literaturen vopros," which is like this sort of very strict, sort of stereotypical like analysis of a work, and you have to memorize all of what these critics are saying and to just regurgitate it, and there is no really independent thought in that way. Nothing like this is taught in Bulgarian school. So suddenly when you have the essay form and you have like people making literature alive for you, what my American teacher did for me, she Pamela Inlow, you know, I don't even know where she's now, but she basically, you know, made me love literature. And so when I went to Millbury, I started just taking literature classes and nothing else, and both Russian and American literature. At the time, there was a separate American literature major. But I just thought that always, I don't know, that understanding the world through literature, you understand the mentality of Russians much better when you read Gogol and when you read Dostoevsky, and then when you read a couple of political science books, you know, it's like it just there are certain structures. I mean, I remember going to a performance of Evgeny Onegin in the Taganki theater in Moscow, that famous sort of dissident theater from the 80s. And after the performance, there's this guy with a microphone going around the audience, like, recite your favorite part of Evgeny Onegin. And people just start recite parts, and like everybody in the audience knew stuff. And these are sort of mental structures, this poetry, that have stayed with Russians, specifically with Russian culture. I mean, it's very important. People learn poetry by heart. And suddenly, when you go to Russia and when you have this knowledge of their rhymes and what they've memorized, you can relate to them much more easily. I think in America that does not exist, because just literature is not something that's that kind of fetishized, you know, experience. I think in Russia the sort of romantic idea of the author is still very much alive, and the inspiration, the muse, and so on and so forth. Brodsky was sort of the last bard, right? But in the States you don't get that very much, and yet you could also, you know, reading Moby Dick, you can understand a lot about, I think, American culture and the American mind, and sort of the monomania, or the way it's sort of almost like a Protestant mentality, that you know, and the sort of the pursuit of a goal. You can understand the Iraq War very well by looking at Moby Dick. Let's put it this way. And I think, you know, Hawthorne. I just thought that literature is always the best way to go into a to enter a culture, and to, I'm not sure if poetry is exactly that. It's more sort of a, you know, kind of a more, you know, niche kind of thing. But at the same time, I think with fiction, these are the big narratives, right? It's the big ethics, like, which some theories are that the novel took over the epic, right? As the poem, which was so important for the Greeks for their, let's say, historical sort of understanding and their cultural transmission. And I think the novel was that, maybe not anymore, but at least for a certain period. And I don't know. I just liked reading books, and probably I was just lazy to read any other kind of So I don't know. It's strange. But yeah, I think that it does give you, especially with Russia, I think it does give you a very good sort of grasp of the culture there when you go. You just feel part of it. Because otherwise, I haven't studied that much Russian history. I've read history books, but my understanding when I speak to Russians, like, the way I relate to them is through this kind of literary heritage rather than through, oh, do you know that, you know, like, there was the doctor's trial, you know, at the end of Stalin's rule and all that. You know, it's like, these things are important, of course, to know, but they do not necessarily contribute to understanding the culture as much as a literary work. Mm-hmm. Or reading Pelevin, for example.
Oh, right.
You know, reading Pelevin, you understand the Russian transition in the 90s really well. I mean, this is the book that you need to, you know, Generation Pe, for example. Mm-hmm. This is the book, I think it's translated to something else in English. But it's the Generation Pepsi, right? And so that's the book that you need to read in order to understand how, you know, the transition happened, and better than any other book, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Are there Bulgarian authors that you think have done or are doing interesting work?
There is Georgi Gospodinov, whose work has been translated into English. Dauki Archive Press brought out a book called Natural Novel. Mm-hmm. I like that book a lot. It's sort of very much influenced by Paul Auster and that kind of, like, a little bit of a, you know, late postmodernism, let's put it this way, in the States. And he brought that to Bulgaria and in a Bulgarian context with Bulgarian characters. He's interesting. There is this other guy, Milan Ruskov, who writes strange books. One of them is about 16th century Spain, and it's like a picaresque novel about these two characters who, you know, a doctor and his sidekick, and they go around selling tobacco as an old cure, you know, like, you can cure it. And so the whole book is about these two doctors trying, you know, basically, you know, quacks trying to sell these tobacco recipes to people to cure their diseases. And it's an extremely funny thing, but it doesn't have anything to do with Bulgaria at first, you know, mm-hmm. When you look at it. But yet, when you see how, I mean, there are certain ways you can relate contemporary Bulgaria to this, like, 16th century Spain with, like, people selling, you know, tobacco recipes and trying to have this, I don't know.
Magic cures,
yeah. So you can, and then he wrote a book just recently, Vzvyshenie, which is like, it's written in an invented 19th century, or sort of an echo of 19th century Bulgarian literary language. And it's extremely funny. It's like, it's comedy, you know, in this past. It's also sort of a picaresque, and it's about Bulgarian revolutionaries who are also robbers. Because most, as he says, you know, most, you know,
they were bandits.
Yeah. And we think of them as, like, we put them on the pedestal, we put them on, you know, as, like, monuments, and we, like, you know, we recite their poetry, and we think of them as these national heroes. But a lot of them are bandits. And they ended up also being national heroes because they were fighting the Turkish authorities or disrupting their roots and all that. So So he exploits that. He explores that side of history, which is very refreshing, because suddenly, you know, you see through the novel, you see history as more objective and actually closer to what happened than reading a history book.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm often surprised though when I read Ivan Vazov, for example, Pod Igoto, which is, you know, the national novel in Bulgarian, but. You know, the more I read it, the more you can see how many problems he understood, you know, that, and how many different perspectives he includes in that novel that the main character is kind of sidelined.
Right.
But they're all there.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating book insofar as, you know, like, if you just follow the main character, mm-hmm. who is the most boring, right, then you get the nationalist meta-narrative.
Right.
But all of the other characters and what's going on in that book, you have basically the whole story.
Right, right.
It's fascinating. And somehow the rest of it just doesn't seem...
Yeah.
Didn't make it into the...
It's a very interesting book. It's actually, people, maybe nationalists have overexploited it, mm-hmm. But actually it follows the, you know, the models of Victor Hugo, sort mm-hmm. of, that was a favorite of Ivan Vazov, and he was a favorite, and it was finished in Odessa.
Ah.
By the way, and it was first published, serialized in English before it was published in Bulgarian in a novel form.
That doesn't surprise me.
And so, it was around the whole discourse of the Eastern
Bulgarian
question,
colors,
you know, at the time and all that. So he, when it was published, serialized in England, then it was published as a novel in Bulgarian, then it was published as a novel back in the UK. But it was serialized in this, like, magazines.
Fascinating. I did not know that. That's incredible.
Yeah, it's sort of an interesting little bit of literary history.
Okay, so question about academics, right? So you do a lot of things, you know, you look into a lot of things that academics have looked into or are looking into. How do you see your perspective as complementary, augmentative, or in relation to, like, I mean, you chose, I'm presuming, not to become an academic, but to become a writer. So what? How do you see what you do vis-a-vis what academics who work on this region,
right,
say, do?
I think it's indispensable, the work of academics. It's like, that's the... And I really just, I mean, seriously, I just cannot do this kind of work. But I think, you know, reading to understand the region, to understand the complexity of, you know, because when you read a journalistic narrative, oftentimes things are just so simplified and that you don't get anything out of it. But then the academic world brings you that complexity of understanding of issues. And at the same time, because it is so complex, you know, oftentimes, you know, it doesn't get out into the wider world. There is this kind of, like, huge audience for that kind of writing. And I think maybe trying to preserve a certain kind of balance between the complexity of academic writing and yet the accessibility of journalism is maybe a good way to bridge the two. But yeah, I couldn't really... I mean, I was studying 18th century British travel literature at Berkeley, and it was interesting, and I liked a lot of it, but somehow it felt like so narrow, like you had to focus so narrowly on a certain, and I'm more of a generalist, I think, and I sometimes, like, say stupid things and stupid generalizations that are not exactly true, but at the same time, I do like that kind of perspective where you look at different fields and different periods of time in different countries, rather than let me focus on this, like, 1832 to 1855 and write only a book about that. And I found that generally, literature departments in the States, they tend to, like, focus too narrowly on a certain kind of question, but that kind of wider focus, like wider understanding of literature and of different traditions, it's not really there. It seems that, you know, there will be like this course on something very specific,
mm-hmm.
but then, like, people will not have read like a major novel or something that's very important to understand. You know, it's like it's too specialized sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't. And I and you know, the whole academic market was going down the drain, and like I was sure I couldn't find an academic job because I wasn't participating in conferences and doing sort of the academic work. So even if I had a degree, that wouldn't have helped me much in the real academic market. And the way with adjunct positions now and lecture, you know, it's like I don't earn a lot as a freelancer, but I earn as much as an adjunct.
Yeah, so you get to go places.
So I get to go places, right.
Well, this is one of the things that I really like about your work, is that academics, after a certain point, not all of them, but a lot of them stop going places. Because you get settled and, you
know, right.
And structurally it becomes more difficult, and yet they're called upon, we are called upon to comment on the place, even if, you know, to some extent it's possible that not having been there for a while, you know, touch has been lost, to put it in the ultimate passive form. And what I like about your work is that it demonstrates, you know, not only an intense and deep engagement, but, you know, one that is intensely contemporary, like that you have a feel for the place because you are writing from the place oftentimes and having been there very recently. And that's one thing that I regret about some of our academic work, is that it gets increasingly alienated from the places
right.
themselves. Not always, but
increasingly abstract, theoretical,
yes.
And then
yeah.
Of course when you go in the field, it's different.
Yes, it's very different. Even for something like history, like being in the field changes your perspective on what that history means or can mean.
Right, right.
And so, yeah, that's. I think your work is immensely valuable for all kinds of reasons.
Thank you, Holly.
So let's close on that note, shall we? Thank you.
Thank you.